You're listening to Unpaused, the podcast for women who want to reinvent their career or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. Today, almost three quarters of women work, whether they have children or not. This is compared to 9% of women in the 1940s and 47% in 1975. According to the 2018 Hilda survey of Australian households, while men do more housework than they once did, the greater share of housework and childcare still falls to women, and in particular, mothers. Becoming a mother heralds a dramatic change in the lives of Australian women. New mothers go from spending a weekly average of 2 hours caring for others to a staggering 51 hours. And when women become mothers, they also increase the time they spend on housework, like cooking, cleaning, and washing, leaping from a weekly average of 16 hours to 25 hours in not much more than the blink of an eye. Statistics like these bring the whole issue of gender equality into a new realm. Married with three daughters, Nicolette Rubinstein has lived this conflict and come out the other end with a well-developed plan for how to smooth the way to a happier and fairer household for the working mother. Having led strategy for Colonial First State, the wealth management arm of the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, for 12 years, during the first 2 years of which she also had her first baby, Nicolette knows more than most about thinking her way out of a problem. Despite reducing her hours to become part-time, she managed to retain her rank and position as one of Colonial's general managers and go on to have two more children as well. How did she do it? In her book, Not Guilty, Nicolette documents how she strategically rethought the juggle of motherhood and career. She describes the strategic planning approach she applied to bring family and career into better alignment using a formula she knew well, the McKinsey 7S framework. She believes that the seven internal aspects of work-life harmony in a household need to be aligned in much the same way as they are in business management. Her methodology is laid out in the book, step by step. It's an excellent and detailed how-to guide, one I wish I'd had when I was starting out. Nicolette's book is grounded in the belief that part-time is the best way, and she advocates for that belief throughout. In fact, she was named one of the 10 most powerful part-time workers in Australia in 2014 by Business Insider. At that time, she listed her working hours as 8 to 2:30, 5 days a week. To explain more about the process that she believes can help transform a working mother from exhausted, guilt-ridden and wrung out to a happy career woman, wife and mother, for at least some of the time, let me welcome Nicolette Rubinstein. Nicolette, thanks for making the time to talk.
Thank you, Judith, and what an excellent summary of the book.
Well, I meant it, actually. I wish I had had it when I started out. To understand more about how your brain works, you were an actuary, did an MBA, and eventually came to head strategy at Colonial. What made you good at strategy and what made you so successful that you kept that job for 12 years?
I think I do have a natural inclination to try and synthesize information and see the big picture. And I couple that with an analytical brain that goes hand in hand with maths and being an actuary. The other thing is, I would describe myself as an introvert, but I love interacting with people. So, you know, I feel like I've got strong influencing skills, and sometimes influencing is what's most important in strategy, actually, because you might come up with a strategy, but it's actually getting information from other people and working with them to develop strategy that is really the core of what makes a good strategist. So, yeah, I think it was a few different skills coming together, actually. And you know, fundamentally, I loved that work environment at Colonial First State. I was working with four fantastic CEOs with a great management team. And that's why I wanted to stay there doing that job. I loved the job and felt like I was adding value. And importantly as well, it was a supportive work environment. So they supported my life choices. So things like allowing me to work flexibly, being respectful of the fact that I had children, and allowing me to keep that senior role.
So at what point then, Nicolette, did you start to frame the process
as a strategic planning exercise. The process of actually juggling having children and then rearing children, you know, with those strategic planning eyes. When did you wake up one morning and say, actually, I think I could be doing this better?
Gosh, there's lots of ways to answer that question. I think to begin with, in my mind, there were some absolute must-dos. And I felt very strongly about working part-time while I had children. That was a given for me and a non-negotiable. And then what I realized over time, firstly, I realized that there was a whole lot of books about having babies and what to expect when you're expecting, baby love, all of this material that helped you manage through that process. But to me, the biggest shock was then you're left with a job and a baby and no one's told you about how to balance that. And so the third thing is that over time, I realized that there was a lot of things that I had thought through, but there was a lot of things that I was just lucky. I was in a good company. I had a job that could be done part-time, but I think my analytical brain started to kind of analyze the situation and realize that there was quite a few sort of component parts that actually made my life work more by luck. But you know, as I started to sort of decompose that situation and look at what was making it more manageable, that was sort of the inspiration for the book. A very major insight is that, you know, that there is no silver bullet for this whole career mum thing. There's no single piece of advice that you can give a new career mum that will make it all go swimmingly. That it was a lot of little things. You know, that's sort of what naturally led me to use the McKinsey framework, because it has these seven S's, the seven different parts of your life. And when I gave it some thought, I realized that you can apply that same strategic process, not just to a business, but to your own life and think through what makes it workable.
And when do you think in an ideal world does the strategizing begin?
Gosh, I would say at least 5 years before you have children would be the ideal situation. Because the three things that I think made it easier for me was being in the right job that I could do part-time. And now, you know, things have changed a lot. That was 15 years ago, but now there's a lot more open-mindedness, particularly post-COVID and everyone working from home. That means that things can be done flexibly. But I was in a strategy role. I didn't have a large team. So I was in the right role, right company, supportive work environment. And I had a boss that was supportive, a boss that let me keep my general manager role when I worked part-time.
General manager is a part of the executive team. So that would have been quite a big thing at the time.
It was a very big deal. In the whole of CBA, you know, there was only two or three part-time general managers. Interestingly, another one of them was a man who ran strategy in the main part of the bank. But yeah, it was highly unusual. And going into that, I fully expected to have to give up my general manager role when I asked to work part-time. So I look back at that point and I realized that it was one of those sliding door moments which put me on a different trajectory. I'm forever grateful to that boss, the CEO at the time, who agreed to me working part-time.
So to go to your framework and the McKinsey 7S framework, central to that is the idea of shared values that you set up in your family as the guiding principles that will help you navigate these two very different roles. I found that so logical, and yet it's a conversation that so often doesn't happen. Can you talk about the way that works in your mind?
Yeah, and you're completely right. It often goes unsaid, and yet it is critical to a women's work-life balance. Just to draw the analogy, in a business context, shared values is about the culture of the organization. In your marriage or your partnership, it's really about being on the same page as your partner. And can I just say completely that I don't think I really got this right. I look back and I cannot believe this, but I don't think my husband and I ever had a conversation that said something like how much of a role is each of us going to play in raising these children. It was just assumed. He would keep on his job and I would do most of the child rearing. And I look back and I think that is the number one question that you should be having out loud, probably before you're even pregnant. And it's shared values, it's getting on the same page. And I really think that, you know, one of those critical aspects of success is sharing the workload with your partner. Unless you've sort of very lucky to have a house husband or partner, then you do have to share the workload.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, things have moved a long way and a lot of men are much more involved in that. But it seems to me that the approach you've advocated involves a lot of negotiation. So what would you see from your background in business as the essential skills for negotiating successfully? Because that's also something that not all of us are great at.
Yeah, and to be honest, I would say that I'm not a great negotiator, but I feel like I am a very principled person. So my starting position was, this is a given, I'm going to work part-time. The other area that my husband and I did come to a very shared values, shared understanding of was getting help at home. So he was very supportive of that. So even though he didn't work part-time or flexibly and play a large role in the day-to-day caring, he was very supportive of getting help in the form of nanny or a babysitters or cleaning. So I felt like we were on the same page there. And to be honest, I think that was another critical ingredient of success for me, was having that help at home, because we didn't really have grandparents that could help out. And I do feel like Australian women generally, and this is a mass generalization, but we don't get the help we need at home sufficiently to support what we're doing in the workplace. And we very quickly end up doing two jobs, being a mother, carer, wife, as well as our day jobs, which, you know, can be big jobs and stressful and long hours.
Yes, it's interesting that I've noticed with women I've interviewed who've had big careers that they don't really want to talk about outsourcing. They don't want to admit that they're not doing it all, because I think that it sort of suggests that rules a line between the haves and the have-nots, whereas it might just be once a month that you can get some help just to lighten the load until everybody's old enough to help a little bit more. Do you think that that's a secret?
I've thought a lot about why career women don't get more help. And I do think one of them is what you've just touched on, which is this, what I would say is actually a beautiful egalitarian kind of culture in Australia. But I think there are kind of other things going on. I think a lot of us weren't raised with help at home, so it's not something that we default to. I do think as well there's a sort of perfectionism, sort of expectation that we will do it all as well. So I think there's a bit of a darker side of it, not just the sort of lovely egalitarian philosophy. There's part of us that thinks it's our job and we have to do it, and we have to move away from it because it's just not physically possible. I've seen a lot of women in the workplace just really struggle under the load of trying to do it all.
And is this something that is discussed in the workplace, you know, in terms of just supportive conversation to let other women know that it's okay not to have these incredibly high standards, or if they want to have those, if they want everything to be perfect, that they, it's quite reasonable to say, well, there aren't going to be enough hours in the day, you're probably going to have to get some help?
I don't think we do have it enough in the workplace, actually. And my observation is that we often get there eventually, but just way too slowly. And once we're there, then we become big advocates for how to do it. But when you look at it, I come across very senior women who have got big jobs, kids, lots of caring responsibilities, and then go home on the weekend and do their cleaning on top of ferrying kids around. The other thing that I've observed is just how women respond. You can see it physically on someone's face when they are not getting enough sleep, just doing too much stress at work. And I've seen women go on extended periods of sick leave. They're just not coping. Your immune system might break down, whatever physical aspect in your body reacts. And there is a great book called The Running Woman Syndrome, which captures it brilliantly, how we just run around like mad things. And, you know, the pressure that we put up onto our physical bodies. And she just noticed it as a phenomenon. She would see these women coming into her clinic and just see the stress inherent in these women. And I just think it's not sustainable.
I want to come back to this negotiation. If you were in your strategy job at the bank and you were trying to introduce a new strategy that you'd worked on with a group of people to develop, that this was the direction you wanted, you felt was the right direction for the company, how do you gather support for that? How do you recruit support for something that's a big change? And what could we learn from that? Is there something there? Because I think this negotiation point is a big one.
The natural business technique I would use, I would say that I'm a strong influencer. So I would often firstly understand the facts of the situation and then go around and have one-on-one meetings with the key decision makers. And what I've learned over my career is that if you want to have a smooth meeting where you get the outcome that you want, you have to do the behind the scenes discussions with the individuals that are the main decision makers before you get to that meeting, and not just clash in the meeting, try to do a big convincing session. So I do think that influencing is important. Now, how does that translate into the case of a career mum? I think there's influencing with your partner, and that is, it is this getting on the same page. What kind of parents do we want to be? Do we want our child to be in 5 days of daycare, 12 hours a day? What do we think is reasonable for the parent's proportion of time that the child is with a parent as opposed to somebody else? These are all hard questions that I think when you have the discussion, I think you will generally come out in agreement, actually. But if you're not careful and you don't have those discussions up front, you might default into a situation which is either you doing everything or putting your child into a lot more care than you might otherwise want.
You make the observation that income and happiness don't necessarily correlate, that the unending quest for more money is not necessarily going to get the returns on happiness that we think will come. I don't hear it discussed very often. And maybe the millennials have got this a little bit more in perspective than my generation.
I think that's true, actually, that the next generation might have got this a bit more sorted than we did. But yeah, my own personal reflection was that I think for most of my 20s and probably most of my 30s, I was still defaulting to achievement, house, car, the much more material aspects being key to happiness without questioning that sort of railroad that I was on. And, you know, it took a long time for me to realize that that was not the keys to happiness. And I did quote some data in the book that actually shows that even numerically, the research suggests that you probably don't need much more than 100,000 a year and the happiness levels plateau, suggesting that more money doesn't make you happier. And, you know, that leads to the question, well, what does make you happier? And, you know, there is a brilliant TED talk by Robert Waldinger on that exact question. And, you know, their conclusion, and that's out of a Harvard 80-year longitudinal study, the key conclusion is relationships. And I just think that is such an important thing for career mums to keep in mind, because, you know, if you're not careful, you will pursue your career at all costs. And in terms of how you divide your time, you can end up spending a lot more time on career than family or partner or friends, all of those things that probably in the long term, you know, the research suggests are very key to happiness. So I really celebrate all of this work that's been done on happiness. We should use that in how we frame our day-to-day lives. And there's no doubt achievement is important to our feeling of self-esteem. So I don't want to dismiss that. But equally, we need to focus on our relationships and we need to make sure we don't sacrifice them in pursuit of more materialistic aims.
I thought it was great that you really expressed that as being fundamental to the whole purpose of this exercise, that actually the whole exercise is really relationship driven, isn't it? It's all about your relationship with your partner and getting that into alignment, the relationship with your children and the people who care for them, And then all of these external relationships that really do come a very poor third, and yet they are the things that will sustain you. I thought it was so cleverly done. I must say, Nicolette, I think it's a fantastic book. You're very explicit, though, about embracing your femininity as a benchmark of success. And again, that's something that I don't read a lot about. How do you see that femininity feeding into this whole picture of a woman at work?
Again, that came from my own personal journey because, you know, my first job was in Cape Town, South Africa, in an actuarial department in a life insurance company. So it was a pretty male-dominated environment. I realized looking back that I was adopting what you might call more male behaviors or approaches without even thinking, and just because I thought that that's what was needed to get ahead. And if you think about the women that were successful in the 80s and 90s, and they did this because they had to, but they were, you know, very sort of masculine forms of women in many ways. And whereas now I think the biggest gift we have is being able to be ourselves in the workplace and being confident what we bring to the table is good for business. And in my mind, that's things like empathy, ability to work in a team, focus on a customer. You know, there's a lot of female traits and they're not exclusive to women at all, but they're more associated with women, you know, perhaps lower ego. And also, interestingly, there's some evidence to suggest that we are better risk managers as well. So we're more cautious in many ways. So I think we need to be more aware of what these good female traits are and more confident being ourselves in the workplace. And at a broad level, that might be feeling confident to show compassion, which 20 years ago, it was sort of much more embraced to be harsh and based and goals focused. Whereas, you know, these days, I think I embrace sort of boardroom or management conversations where we can do the right thing.
What about the part-time model? Can you talk a little bit about that so that we understand exactly what the difference is between part-time and the more casualization approach to employment? What were the things that you think you retained by having a part-time rather than a full-time role? And what were the things you had to trade off?
So the first thing is I actually have done different models over time, and broadly they would all be called flexible working, but for about 8 years, when I had my first child, I worked part-time, but I came in every day and I worked 7 to 1. So that was quite a different model because most people would have worked 3 days a week or 4 days a week. The model really worked well for a few reasons. Firstly, I feel like I had quality hours with my new baby girl every single day. So rather than some days when you would be with her the whole day and some days that you wouldn't be with her at all. I think it worked from a work point of view because I was there every day and I didn't get treated as part-time. And a lot of people will say part-time can sometimes be tough because you get forgotten and you're not invited to the same meetings and you might not be copied in on emails. I never had that issue. And I was also there every day if anything urgent came up. So I feel like it was a good option for my boss. Clearly, the downsides are the sort of transaction time of getting into and out of work, depending on where you live relative to work. A lot of those things are being broken down now. Everything I see in the workplace now, working, going to work or going to the office 3 days a week is going to fast become a norm. So that really opens up a lot of possibilities. The other big barrier, interestingly, is childcare and the fact that it's often framed as a full day of childcare. So why would you only work half a day and have to pay a full day of childcare fees? I went down mainly using a nanny route, which was very good in terms of that model that I'd set up, but also good in terms of managing stress levels as well. It's much easier for the mother. Reflecting on the models over time, what did I give up? I do think my career went sideways probably for about 10 years, but I was incredibly happy with that. Again, it comes back to the sort of strategic thinking that I think you have to make trade-offs. A big believer in the saying, you can have it all, not all at the same time. And I feel like you cannot have a full-on career and raise young children. It is pretty close to impossible. So you've got to work out what your priorities are. I think my career is a good example of putting it on hold, but staying in the workplace and then picking it up when, you know, now my youngest is 10. And each year I feel like I get a bit more flexibility to dedicate more to my career and some of my other passions as well.
You're confident, Nicolette, that there's a lot of time left after you've had your children to realise your career aspirations. And there's a very good book that I've read on this called The 100-Year Life, which is the sort of life my grandchildren, your children will have. But we also know that ageism is real, and probably especially for women, because we're judged on how we look as well. What's been your experience on that?
Yeah, one of my other passions is around longevity and aging, coming from my actuarial background. I've said publicly, and I do presentations, I want to live to 100. So that is my time frame that I'm looking at. My mom's 78, my dad's nearly 80. They're still running their own businesses. And my inspiration actually for having the confidence to put my career on hold and knowing that it would come back was actually my mother. So my mom, when she was young, she was a secretary in London. When she had children, she didn't work, so she spent all of her time looking after us. And then we actually emigrated from England to South Africa, and my family came under a bit of financial strain then, and my mom decided to go back to work. In her mid-40s, she ended up setting up her own insurance broking business, and that's the business that she's still running today. So completely reinvented herself, and, you know, it's become a thriving little family business. She employs my brother and my sister. And it just shows you that you shouldn't think that your mid-40s is, you know, it's downhill from here. It was very much the inspiration to that you've got to think of, you know, I think we all have to think of reinventing ourselves multiple times in our careers, actually.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say that. You reference what Jack Welch calls the chit system. And I thought that he said this very well, but then you extrapolated on this, that the more chits you have, the better your ability to negotiate the terms you want. That obviously worked for you, Nicolette, but there are a few constraints on that as well. Or you frame this very well by talking about how you've got to build your own brand as you work.
That is a brilliant book, Jack Welch's book, Winning. And it's, gosh, it must be nearly 20 years old now, but it's still, you know, the business thinking in that is brilliant. In some ways, you might think it's a little bit outdated, because when I first went part-time, there was no flexibility policies. You know, now we know 70% of companies actually have a flexible work policy. So when I first went part-time, I think it was much more dictated by that sort of chit system, which is you were able to negotiate based on your own credibility in the workplace and your personal brand. And the more valuable you were to your company, the more likely you were to be able to negotiate an arrangement that suited you. And Jack Welch explained that brilliantly well. I think now the workplace has changed. We've had some companies that have come out and said any job can be done flexibly. So the default settings have changed a bit. I'm still a big believer that your own personal brand and credibility will still dictate what you can negotiate at work. And it's worth coming back to your earlier question about when do you start thinking about all of this. You know, make sure that before you have children that you have that recognition in the workplace. It really helps you sort of sustain yourself during the child-rearing years.
What about looking at it from the other perspective, from the workplace perspective? What is the single most important thing that you see characterising a workplace that a woman considering this situation should look for? Where do you begin in analysing how sympathetic a workplace will be?
Well, you have to go by reputation, but in all of the things, and I think I mentioned it before, your direct boss is the biggest influencer. So, you know, I've seen a lot of companies that have been, you know, whatever, women's employer of the year and great policies, and on paper they look fantastic. But if you're direct boss doesn't support what you are doing, then you're generally stuffed. So, you know, what does that mean you look for? I think proportions of women in senior roles. The big one for me is proportion of women working part-time, and an even better indicator would be proportion of men working part-time. proportion of men taking carers leave, paternity leave, because that's when you know when a company has really got it and is really supportive. Funnily enough, as part of writing the book, I have been into lots of different workplaces just to do a presentation, but just chatting to some of the women and men, and you very quickly work out what's going on in a workplace. I now have a very good feel for which companies are, you know, truly supportive work environments and which aren't.
You referred in the book to a TED talk by Michael Kimmel talking about why men should share domestic duties, that there's a big payoff for men who are fantastic around the house.
Yeah, I love that, coming at it from the man's point of view. Like, what is in it for men to have better gender diversity? What he points to, and it's gold, is that the research suggests that men that help out at home, the children are better off, they have better academic results, better participation, the women are better off, lower rates of depression, happier, but amazingly, the men themselves are better off and drink less, take less drugs, lower rates of depression. But the very funny bit is that men who help out at home have more sex.
So. Do you think women are sort of sometimes their own worst enemy, though? Terrible delegators?
Yeah, we're perfectionists. I've definitely suffered from this. And I think my husband goes out of his way, you know, if you say, can you make dinner? And he gives them 3-day-old Indian takeaway or something.
Yeah.
Like, almost as a way of sabotaging his own. You know, and there's a lot of advice that will just say, take a deep breath and just let it go. But, you know, you are inclined to just do it because you know that it will be done properly. So I do think we can be our own worst enemy, but I also think a little bit of research suggesting that Australian men are some of the worst at helping out around the home, and that's a cultural dynamic that we're probably not very aware of. On average, I've seen some research that suggests that Australian women are more attracted to the sort of macho type man. And so therefore we're kind of making our own bed in a way. And, you know, to the example that I saw compared was Swedish culture, where the women are attracted to men who are more happy to help out and, you know, more domestic. But we as Australian women are more attracted to the macho version. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of advice that says choose your partner carefully.
No, we've spent a bit of time on that. But there is also new thinking about adequate being the new excellent, that we have to change our mindset too.
Yes, gosh, and that is hard, isn't it? Because I feel like that is broad-ranging as well. That is, your house doesn't have to be tidy all the time. Your work doesn't have to be 100%. Your children, it's fine if they have takeaways a couple of nights a week. I do also feel like there's a certain profile of a successful woman who does really well from a career point of view, who there's that element of perfectionism in us that it's really hard to get over. So I would recommend, there are some great little talks on adequate is the new excellent.
Yeah, and I think it's got to come sort of across the generations too, as mothers letting go of some of those standards. And I'm the worst person to be talking about this, but, you know, we demonstrate that these are the things that are important and these are the things that can slide. And so that gets translated across the generations, because I don't know where this perfectionism came from. I suspect it came from America. You know, that idealized 1950s housewife where everything's sparkling clean and perfectly done, and it's just not achievable.
Yeah. And again, there's a great TED talk called Teaching Your Girls to Be Brave, Not Perfectionists. And it points out that, I think her name is Rashmi, they point out with boys, you know, we teach them to be brave, but girls from a very early age, we teach them to be perfectionists. But it's little examples about how we comment on what the girl wears the whole time. Mm-hmm. We teach them good manners. We teach that. I've caught myself about teaching the girls how to lay a table with a very perfectionistic, perhaps over-the-top attitude towards how the table needs to be laid. So I catch myself doing it with three girls. I catch myself teaching them to be perfectionists without really realizing what I'm doing.
I want to turn to your current, the direction that you've taken your career into, the non-executive director realm. I want to talk to you about a couple of areas that I don't know a lot about, but that your career has sort of dovetailed into, and that's superannuation and insurance. But if we could go to superannuation and the whole issue of part-time work and the fact that women taking time out of their full-time careers also are penalised by losing that buffer of super, which is so important later in life. Have you thought a lot about that?
Well, the sort of scary stats are that women are retiring with 40% less super than men. One in three women don't have any money in their super account in retirement. And probably the most worrying one is nearly 40% of single women in retirement are living in poverty. So I feel very passionately about women needing to have financial independence. There's a great government report that says a husband is not a financial plan. And it's so true. I also feel strongly that fiddling around the edges with the superannuation system is not the way to solve this. Keeping women in the workforce, be that part-time or full-time, that the biggest issue is actually the gaps that we have in our work life and not going back to work at all. So on average, women are spending 6 years out of the workforce. And then when we go back, we go part-time and not full-time in many cases. So those issues with how much we're retiring on is very much around just not earning enough during our work lives. And if we fix that, and to me, the key to fixing that is encouraging women back to work, be it part-time or full-time, whatever you feel like doing, and making sure we fix the gender pay gap. And part of that, we need to fix the childcare and make sure that women have access to childcare. And I'm sure you've come across this a lot, Judith, but the women that I meet that have chosen to stay out of the workforce and raise children, what happens, and listen, I know I'm very supportive for women who want to do that, they should, but the issue is that their confidence levels plummet and they struggle then to get back into the workforce when they do want to get back into the workforce. And, you know, I with these huge rates of divorce, and the other big issue is domestic violence, actually. You need your financial independence, and I think it is critical not to rely on somebody else for your financial independence.
And what about in these roles as directors of these different organisations? Is this something that comes up? Is it really a government issue, or is it lobbying from below? Is it something that you're involved in?
From a director's point of view, there's a few things that you can have a look at. One thing is the great work that WGEA is doing, the Women's Gender Workplace Gender Equality Agency. So if you've got more than 100 people, you now have to report to WGEA on gender pay gap, that sort of thing. So that is forcing a level of focus at boards that we've never had before. It means that the analysis is brought to the board around different levels in the organisation, what percentage male, female you've got, and whether they are being paid equally. So I think that is a really good place to start. The second area, I think, is from a board point of view, asking what percentage of women are returning to work after maternity leave. And it's such a simple stat, but it's so indicative of the health of an organisation and whether that flexible work policy that you've got in place is actually working in practice. And the third one that I would love to see more of is what percentage of men are taking paternity leave. Because again, as soon as the men start working part-time and taking paternity leave, it will normalise it and give permission to men and women to take it.
Listening to Nicolette speak, I was struck by how well she knows her strengths and plays to them. She says she has strong influencing skills, even though she's an introvert. She's principled. She values her femininity and uses it to set her own benchmarks of success and achievement. She knew that work was too important for her to abandon it altogether as she planned her family, She knew there would be trade-offs, but that she could live with them, confident there would be time to address the inevitable disappointments of being passed over, and she backed herself. Reading her book and talking to her just now, I was struck by the number of good ideas she referenced from speakers and thinkers she admired. The TED Talk library was an especially rich vein of inspiration. I made a point of going back to the TED Talk she mentioned in the interview to listen, and you might do the same. Michael Kimmel on why gender equality is good for everyone, men included. Reshma Sajani on teaching girls bravery, not perfection. And Robert Waldinger on what makes a good life. Each of them is a provocative conversation starter. Also, while we didn't go through all seven parts of Nicolette's strategic planning exercise from Not Guilty, choosing to focus just on the first one of agreeing shared values, if you're struggling with making the burden of work and home more fair, then the seven-step methodology that Nicolette sets out in her book is a great place to start. I don't think it's ever too late to begin a conversation to better clarify the shared values that help shape how you work and live more fairly together. Thanks to Nicolette Rubinstein for sharing her wisdom, Leonie Marsh for producing, Jason Milhouse for recording, and Claudia Cameron for research. I'll make sure there's information about Not Guilty and those TED Talks she mentioned on the website, www.unpaused.net. That's all from Unpaused. Until next time, farewell.